Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley. Supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. Lewis, Longman, and Walker, a Florida law firm helping clients navigate the maze of regulatory and political processes. Offices in Tallahassee and statewide. More about Lewis, Longman, and Walker's legislative lobbying and other governmental affairs practices is at llw-law.com. And from HR Florida State Council, advocating for the workplace on behalf of 14,000 human resource professionals and 6,300 Florida employers. HR Florida State Council, a resource for lawmakers, media, and human resource professionals. HRFlorida.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
There's a consensus that Florida public schools test too much, but now there are two competing bills in the legislature to reverse that trend.
The time has come to address this issue. There's a growing chorus of people that are frustrated about the magnitude of testing that's going on in our system.
Also tonight, some of Florida's local governments see their authority being challenged by the state legislature, and they are not happy about it.
I think it's overzealous legislation and not understanding what home rule really means.
We'll also learn about a push to do away with mandatory medical coverage for motorists and hear about a bill that would finally give Florida foster kids the car keys. I'm Tom Flanagan. It's the start of the fourth week of the 2017 Florida lawmaking session. Welcome to Capitol Report. A Senate education panel has temporarily postponed a school testing overhaul bill, putting one of the two major testing proposals in jeopardy. Lynn Hatter reports on the latest between warring testing philosophies in the legislature.
We have heard from parents, we have heard from teachers, we have heard from students that they need relief.
Earlier this month, a bipartisan group of lawmakers led by Tallahassee Democratic Senator Bill Montford derided Florida's school testing system, and they vowed to change the way students are tested, schools graded, and teachers evaluated. Bill Montford's bill eliminates end-of-course exams in certain subjects, does away with the state's controversial teacher evaluation formula, and allows districts to use the SAT and ACT in place of other state exams. The antipathy over testing has built on years of increasing public concerns, fueled by vocal parent groups who say Florida is overtesting its students and getting little to nothing in return. Montford says his proposal is just common sense.
It puts control back in the hands of our teachers and our principals and our parents. It eliminates duplicative testing. Most of all, it lets our teachers get back to teaching.
The effort at an overhaul follows a vow by Senate Education Committee Chairman David Simmons, who has promised that changes are on the way. It's also being supported by Senator Tom Lee, who at one point approved of the state's testing system, but now says it's gone too far.
And it is a symbol of the fact that the time has come to address this issue. There's a growing chorus of people that are frustrated about the magnitude of testing that's going on in our system. This bill does a lot of things. There's another bill in the process right now that I also think is reflective of the fact that there's acknowledgement of a problem. That bill has great talking points, but if you read it, it does nothing.
The other bill is a proposal by Republican Senator Ana Terry Flores. Her Fewer Better Tests bill is being cheered by the Foundation for Florida's Future, former Governor Jeb Bush's education advocacy group. But it's running headlong into opposition from parent organizations like Sue Woltansky's Common Ground.
The other bill, if it were to pass with the proficiency level included, would massively increase failure rates. School grades would plummet. District grades would plummet.
Woltansky says Flores's proposal does nothing to limit testing in the state, and she's worried language in the bill requiring Florida to align its student scoring scale to that of a national test called NAEP will only hurt students. Woltansky says her group would much rather have Montford's bill.
There's still work to do. You know, we wouldn't be back to complete common sense, but it would be a major step in the right direction.
We're going to turn to tab 4, which is Senate Bill 926 by Senator Flores.
Flores's bill was slated to be heard Monday, but it was temporarily postponed by Senator Tom Lee.
You are recognized to explain the bill. I know there's a series of amendments.
Yes, I'd like to move to temporarily pass this bill.
I'd like a
roll call vote.
Both Lee and Simmons are supporting the other bill. And ahead of Monday's hearing, Simmons filed several amendments that would have moved Flores's bill closer to Monford's. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
Florida mayors have been ramping up the pressure on legislators. As Jim Ash reports, local governments are complaining about what they consider to be the biggest legislative power grab in modern history.
A handful of mayors gathered on the fourth floor of the Capitol with a simple message: vote no on House Bill 17. Behind them were the big doors to the Senate chamber, but the mayors say, at least metaphorically, their backs are to the wall. Their biggest concern is Palm Bay Representative Randy Fine's proposal to preempt all local business regulations, unless authorized by state law. Palm Shores Mayor Carol McCormack says the rookie Republican is essentially clueless about how government works.
I think you have a lot of new legislators who want to come up here and make a name for themselves, maybe, but I think it's overzealous legislation and not understanding what home rule really means.
Critics of the legislation insist government closest to the people governs best, and the Florida Constitution appears to back that up. In 1968, voters approved an amendment establishing home rule. The problem dates back to the 1800s and the early 1900s. As the country grew, local governments had to rely on states for all their legal power. Legislatures were flooded with requests for special acts or general laws of local application. Home rule gave local governments the power to govern themselves, as long as their ordinances didn't conflict with federal or state law. HB 17 turns all that on its head, says the Florida League of Cities' Scott Dudley.
What happened after that is that when the legislature wants to preempt a local government, they have to pass a bill to do it. This actually reverses it, where if we want to regulate something, we have to go to the legislature and get specific permission in order to do that.
Fine may be a freshman, and HB 17 may be his first bill, but Fine is hardly clueless. The millionaire owner of a casino management business is a Harvard MBA. Fine says he just wants to look at economic development in a different way.
We've been having a broad discussion in this room and, frankly, around the legislature and around the state about the nature of economic development. I think we have focused disproportionately around one topic, the idea of incentives. But there are many ways that a state can compete.
Fine says predictable, reasonable, and uniform regulation would add to Florida's corporate appeal.
And one of the ways that states can compete is their regulatory climate. We frankly compete in other ways. We don't have an income tax, and that appeals to many people in thinking about coming to Florida.
Fine says he deliberately left out which business regulations the bill would preempt because he wanted to give local governments flexibility. That raises constitutional issues about vagueness. And it leaves critics like Tallahassee Democratic Representative Lauren Owsley grasping for examples.
I think it's important, if we're voting on this, for us to kind of know what those, you know, is it possible for us to get a list of that, to know what is expressly already authorized and what we're, you know, what we're looking at here.
Critics immediately turned to zoning and whether local governments would still be able to bar or regulate not-so-family-friendly enterprises.
In this community, you will notice, we do not have adult entertainment in Leon County, and that is an ordinance that was passed in the 80s. The local government made that decision. Is it your position that that's a zoning decision and that that would not be impacted by this?
Fine says he's been assured the bill wouldn't leave local governments that helpless. Fine promised a House panel he would make sure all their questions were answered. But the League's Dudley says Fine's bill isn't the only assault on home rule. Community redevelopment agencies are under attack, as well as local government control of telecommunications and ride-hailing apps like Uber and Lyft. One of the biggest concerns is what HB 17 would mean for local power to protect the environment. Sierra Club lobbyist David Cullen uses the example of fertilizer ordinances that keep pollution out of waterways. Fine's bill would create an expensive trap, Cullen warns.
It is so much cheaper and so much more effective But if you don't allow that to be controlled, then those local communities are the ones that are on the hook under the Clean Water Act. They're the ones that have to pay the fines.
The Senate so far has shown little interest in fines, Bill, but the Florida League of Cities remains on high alert. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Jim Ash.
By a vote of 7-5, the House Justice Appropriations Subcommittee approved a proposal today that would increase penalties for undocumented immigrants who commit certain types of violent crimes. Under the legislation, crimes such as sexual battery, aggravated assault with a deadly weapon, armed burglary, and murder would all be reclassified to a higher degree penalty when committed by someone who is in the country illegally. For example, a first-degree misdemeanor would be bumped up to a third-degree felony, while a crime that's typically a third-degree felony would become a second-degree felony, and so forth and so on. Opponents of the measure say the bill's likely unconstitutional since it treats people differently for committing the same crime. But supporters, including House bill sponsor Dane Eagle, says the only way to tell if the bill is constitutional is to pass it, and that the safety of American citizens justifies the measure. The legislation still has one more committee stop in the House before it's ready for a vote by the full chamber. An identical bill in the Senate also has to be heard by another committee, having already passed two. Once again, Florida's Motor Vehicle No-Fault Law, also known as Personal Injury Protection or PIP, is coming under fire in the legislature. Florida Representative Aaron Grawl argues that the person who caused the accident should pay the consequences.
We can bring meaningful value into a system that places fault appropriately on the person who caused the accident.
A panel of lawmakers says people should know when their house has a septic tank, but often they don't.
11 years ago, I moved back to Florida, and I bought a fairly expensive house. And the only thing I knew was I was excited I wasn't going to have a sewer bill. I was like, great.
Florida lawmakers are working to make a pilot program permanent to help the state's foster kids.
We all know what a stressful time it is to be 16 years old and try to get a driver's license. That's always a stressful time. But if you're a foster care child, it's almost impossible.
Support for Capital Report is provided by the Able Trust, believing growth of Florida's economy depends on a diverse and inclusive workforce. The Able Trust works with the business community to include talented Floridians with disabilities as vital team members. More information is at abletrust.org.
Since the 1970s, Florida drivers have been required by law to carry something called personal injury protection, or PIP insurance. But now, amidst charges of widespread fraud, some Florida lawmakers would like to see the PIP coverage requirement dropped. We get more on that story from Sarah Mueller.
Edgewater resident Adrienne Gorham was driving with her children in Leesburg in 2015 when she was struck by a speeding driver. Gorham says a Corvette ran a red light and T-boned her car, striking the driver's side door from the side. She and her daughter were knocked out.
When I came to, my son was actually already out of the vehicle running around trying to get help, screaming for help. And then I was like, Emily, Emily, and she wasn't responding. And that's when I realized her face was down in the seat in a pool of blood. And I freaked out and thought the worst.
Florida's Motor Vehicle No-Fault Law, also known as Personal Injury Protection or PIP, requires all drivers to carry $10,000 in medical, disability, and funeral protection. That's no matter who's at fault in the accident. Gorham says she's struggling to pay her family's medical bills she's stuck with because the at-fault driver only had the minimum coverage. She says she supports legislation by Representative Aaron Grawl to do away with PIP and raise bodily injury coverage to $25,000 a person and $50,000 per incident. Bodily injury would be required before registering a vehicle. But insurance companies and physician groups oppose the legislation. Insurance companies say dumping PIP moves Florida to a system of litigation. Adrienne Gorham can't sue the other driver because of Florida's no-fault law, but that would change with a mandatory bodily injury system. Here's Representative Grail.
We can bring meaningful value into a system that places fault appropriately on the person who caused the accident.
Florida's PIP law has long been blamed for insurance fraud. Its laws have been revised several times since 2000 to try to curb fraud, but those reforms have also limited coverage. PIP was created in 1971 as a way to reduce lawsuits over traffic claims. Opponents of the legislation say they can't support the legislation because it doesn't protect them from phony legal claims. Orlando attorney Coretta Anthony Smith disputes the charge that changes opens the door to fraudulent claims, but she says taking PIP away would hurt low-income Floridians who are injured. She says getting through the court process would take too long.
My most recent case that I felt really bad for her, she was an employee at Chick-fil-A. She's walking across the street to catch a bus, and she's hit by a car. So thankfully, she did have the $10,000 in PIP coverage to pay for her lost wages that didn't even go to medical bills and went to her lost wages because she couldn't work. She couldn't walk at all.
Lawmakers most recently made changes to Florida's no-fault law in 2012. The aim was to reduce Floridians' auto premiums and reduce PIP claim amounts. A legislative analysis shows that premiums fell by more than a statewide average of 13% as of January 2014, but a 2016 report on the reforms found the savings are eroding. Adrienne Gorham's family still suffers from the 2015 car accident. Gorham has pain every day because of the accident. Her daughter's face hit the back passenger window, and she has trouble breathing out of her nose. Her son suffered hip and spinal injuries. She says she's hounded by creditors every day on the thousands of dollars in medical bills she owes. She didn't have medical insurance at the time because she made too much to qualify for Medicaid.
Every day I get a bill. I get 3 to 4 harassing phone calls every single day. I literally cannot answer my phone without disguising my voice or not answering it at all.
Grawl's bill made it out of its first committee, but it still faces an uphill battle. Similar legislation is also filed by Senator Jeff Brandes, Senator Tom Lee, and Representative Bill Hager. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sarah Mueller.
A measure moving through the House aims at helping Florida officials and homeowners get a better handle on their septic tanks. That story now from Regan McCarthy.
Most of Florida sits on top of what's essentially a sieve. It's a porous limestone base that allows almost anything that seeps into the ground to slip right through into the underground aquifer. Palm Bay Republican Representative Randy Fine says that's concerning when one considers how many septic systems have been installed in the state.
The Department of Health believes that almost 10% of them are not working properly. That translates to 200,000 to 300,000 systems leaking human waste and nutrients into our environment. And we never bother to check them.
In fact, Fine says some people may not even be aware they have them.
And if you want an example of this, you can look at me. 11 years ago, I moved back to Florida, and I bought a fairly expensive house. And the only thing I knew was I was excited I wasn't going to have a sewer bill. I was like, great, I didn't get my septic tank inspected.
Fine is sponsoring a bill that would require homeowners to disclose to potential buyers that the home in question uses a septic tank. It also directs the Department of Health to get an accurate count of the number of septic tanks in Florida. The measure garnered the support of Audubon Florida Executive Director Eric Draper.
We think that information is the most important technology that you have to be able to address water quality problems. We've got a well-established process in the state of Florida, 40067, that requires DEP to identify the sources of nutrients in our waterways. I see this bill as a step forward in being able to help us to identify things.
But another environmental group, the Sierra Club of Florida, is on the opposite side of the argument. A lobbyist for the organization spoke against an amendment from Fine that required a disclosure of septic tanks at the point of sale, but doesn't require an inspection. Realtors have also raised concerns with the measure. Andrew Rutledge is the public policy representative for the Florida Realtors.
With all due respect to the sponsor and the problem he's trying to address, we have some concerns over the proposed disclosure language in a sense that it may not achieve its intended purpose of encouraging buyers to have their on-site sewage inspected, but rather it may stigmatize properties that have on-site sewage. In other words, after receiving this disclosure, buyers may not want to purchase these homes.
But Republican Representative Thad Altman argues the disclosure is likely to propel homeowners and home buyers into action.
I think it will help. I do. Because do you have disclosure? There's a septic tank. I think the next question a buyer will ask, How's it working?
The measure passed the House Natural Resources and Public Lands Subcommittee Monday. A similar bill in the Senate has not yet had a hearing. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
Craig Fugate is no stranger to many Floridians. He became a household name during the record-breaking hurricane seasons of 2004 and 2005. Mr. Fugate returned to Florida and Gainesville after stepping down as FEMA administrator back in January. He sat down with meteorologist Jeff Huffman and WUFT reporter Evan Moon to talk about his experiences and the future of disaster response.
He preferred that we call him Craig, with a little C in writing. After 30 years in emergency management, helping Floridians and all Americans through dozens of disasters, the former FEMA administrator is now a private citizen. Evan, let's start with you in his path to the top.
Jeff, Craig's ascension to the highest position in his field was unique, and his recipe for success, simple. My first question to him was, how did you do it?
I just answered my phone.
Answered your phone?
Yeah. You'd be amazed how many times just doing your job and not looking for what next, that people will come to you with offers, totally unexpected.
With hurricane season just 2 months away, are you concerned that there isn't a named director? What are the biggest threats and concerns coming into that?
I think we did our job of making sure that FEMA was equipped, staffed with the right expertise and the right senior career officials to lead the agency until the Trump administration were able to select an administrator. We wanted to make sure that we left FEMA both financially and operational-wise staffed and equipped to respond to whatever may come until the Trump administration gets their political leadership in place.
As Trump considers his replacement, what do you think are some attributes that a successful FEMA director needs?
I think it's a bias towards action. The most perishable, most precious commodity in disaster response is time, and you never get it back. So you want somebody who has the bias towards action that can synthesize a lot of different variables very quickly and know when to push the system to go now versus waiting for a formal request for assistance.
That was former FEMA Administrator Craig Fugate talking with WUFT reporter Evan Moon. Evan, thank you. During my time with him, I was most curious on the response to last year's hurricane season and how this recent fake news storyline may cloud his message.
Craig, thank you so much for your time, and congratulations on the more than 30 years of public service. Now that we are past this 10-year drought and hurricanes, many Floridians' hurricane amnesia may have gone away, but were there still some lessons that we learned? How would you rate the public's response to our biggest threat in more than 10 years here in Florida?
Kind of mediocre. I think too many people have forgotten the lessons that they were waiting for the next forecast to say, well, it may stay off the coast, maybe I don't need to go. And the problem was Matthew was a big enough storm close enough to the coast that just a slight deviation inland would have meant a lot more impacts, and far too many people were hesitating or waiting until too late to evacuate.
As you know, in today's political and media climate, pun intended, I guess, how would you tell all of us, media and those who consume the information, to filter out the noise and to know exactly what the right message is appropriate to the situation?
I think you got to be factual. You can't go wrong giving people the facts. And I think when you really talk about communicating risk, this is what we owe the public, the information to make informed decisions. We need to be authoritative. We need to know our sources. We ought to understand the public's going to check up on us because they're just not going to take our word for it. They're going to go look at different websites. They're going to compare information.
Craig says he is now enjoying some peace and quiet in Gainesville, but still considers himself an emergency manager. And yes, he will still answer his phone. I'm meteorologist Jeff Hoffman from the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network.
That's former FEMA Administrator Craig Fugate in a conversation with meteorologist Jeff Huffman and WUFT reporter Evan Moon. You're listening to Capitol Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally tonight, the Florida Senate has unanimously passed a bill making it easier for foster care kids to obtain a driver's license and car insurance. That story now from Sasha Cordner.
For Anna Zhang, it was hard learning to drive while she was in the foster care system.
I was in care from the age of 14 until 18, and along the way, I had no experience on driving or anything because the bill for keys to independence wasn't in place when I turned 16. So here I was at 18 with no experience, but I had two jobs in order to support myself to move out into the real world.
The 20-year-old is referring to the Keys to Independence program, which started off as a pilot program in 2014. It seeks to address one of the many obstacles foster kids face learning to drive. So the program helps cover the fees associated with driving school, getting a learner's permit, and the cost of insurance. Now, 3 years later, lawmakers are looking to make it permanent. And Zhang says while it won't help her, it will definitely go a long way for those kids still in the system.
So I think making this a permanent program is very important for teens in foster care, and it is a very important resource because we need to be prepared for the real world.
Fernandina Beach Republican Aaron Bean, who's sponsoring the Senate bill, says he's glad lawmakers can make this program permanent.
We've heard from numerous foster care kids that struggled, that said it was almost impossible. Kids that turned 22 that never got a driver's license because it just wasn't available and it was such a hardship to their foster care families that it wasn't. We take it for granted that everybody's going to get a driver's license, and that sadly is not the case. So this program, which the money is already in the budget for the Department of Children and Families to carry it forward, we think it's going to be a big difference in the lives of foster care families.
And Delray Beach Democratic Senator Kevin Rader says this helps build on past foster care reforms put in place by the legislature.
Our foster care kids are our kids, and this is, a movement that we started a few years ago to, first we allowed foster care kids to stay within the state and within our buildings till age 21. Then we allowed their independence to be able to not have be signed off and have fingerprinted and background checks when they went to football games and things of that nature. And now we're going to let them to get driver's licenses and make it easier for them to do so. I think it's a great bill.
The program costs $800,000 to run, and it's projected that more than 1,800 kids will enroll by June of next year. Meanwhile, the bill's House companion recently passed its final committee and is awaiting a floor vote. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Cordner.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Jim Ash, Sasha Cordner, Nick Evans, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, Sarah Mueller, and Kate Payne. We also thank our contributing Florida Public Radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at FBR Cap Report. And please join us each weeknight at this time throughout the 2017 Florida lawmaking session for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows at fprn.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley. Supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. Lewis, Longman & Walker, a Florida law firm helping clients navigate the maze of regulatory and political processes. Offices in Tallahassee and statewide. More about Lewis, Longman & Walker's legislative lobbying and other governmental affairs practices is at llw-law.com. And from HR Florida State Council, advocating for the workplace on behalf of 14,000 human resource professionals and 6,300 Florida employers. HR Florida State Council. A resource for lawmakers, media, and human resource professionals. HRFlorida.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.